All right, we're in RX world. We're in AX world now. And of course, I'm going to start over here because people will recognize you, Brian Grunkenmeyer. How you doing, man?
Hey, I'm doing great.
Excellent.
Excited to be here today.
Cool. So Eric had made an announcement in Yao when we were in Australia in December about the Actor Framework, or AX. Mm-hmm. And Niners have watched that video, and they're very curious. They wanted me to come and do it going deep. And since you guys wrote the Actor Framework, we figured we'd come and talk to you, since you really know what you're talking about, and dig into what this is. So before we begin, let's meet somebody new on the AX team.
I'm Joe Hoig. I've been on the Eric's team for about 6 or 7 months.
Excellent. And you, of course, have been at Microsoft for a while, worked in TPL.
Yeah, I worked on the Parallel Extensions team, doing TPL, async, await, P-Link, that kind of stuff.
Excellent, man. All right, so right off the bat, tell us, dear Brian, what is the Actor Framework, man?
Yeah, so the Actor Framework is a new computing model that we are putting together for the cloud. The entire idea is, let's cut up your problem space slightly differently into small, distinct parts, and we then allow you to run code in the cloud in an easy, transparent way. We're also looking at some good client-side APIs, too. This is going to be great. It's going to vastly simplify the tasks of writing stuff for cloud-based computing. Mm. We're also looking at the client side in a very interesting way. A lot of the attractiveness of this project for me was I was writing some Windows Phone apps, and you know, you want to write a game or something to, say, track all of your activities in a city, but then you realize, you know, this would be way more fun if it interoperated well with all of my friends' applications, or if I could figure out what my friends or which of my friends were in this city at the time. So very quickly you realize it's great to have a way of representing data in the data center, but you also need to get it down to the client device. And if you can make that easy, then it's going to work out great for people.
Excellent. So I mean, I guess we're here today really to talk about how this all works and how you guys designed it. And maybe you could maybe tell us a little bit about the Actor model for people out there who may not, you know, be 100% sure. Is this the same thing that we were talking about when Eric did the Lang.next interview with the creator of Actor models? Of course.
I'm sure Eric had it in mind. Maybe one of the first things we should talk about is some of the motivations behind doing this. I mean, Brian talked about some, but in general, when you talk about cloud computing or distributed computing, there's kind of a lot of hang-ups that people run up against. I mean, you might you think about availability. What happens if one of your nodes goes down? I mean, can you recover from that and get your data back? Talk about communications. If your compute nodes are going to be cooperating with each other, they probably have to communicate with each other. So how do you do that? Talk about update. I mean, how much of a hassle is it to sort of update your service without interrupting it too badly? Scale would be another thing. I would say a concept count could be another thing that people who are used to developing for single box or devices might have to learn a whole bunch of new stuff to figure out the whole distributed world. So that's kind of our motivation and some of the problems that we're trying to solve. Mm-hmm. And we can kind of take a dive into Actors, if you like.
Yeah.
And see what we're doing. Do that.
Great.
So, you know, an Actor can be considered a service. And let's look at what the interface of that service is. The primary method is something called all method. Just pass it a method name, and some arguments. And so, great, this call method thing is going to look up the method associated with that method name, and it's going to call it and pass it these arguments. So then you might ask next, where do the methods come from? And so, you can kind of think of an Actor when it's first launched as something that has no smarts whatsoever, and you have to give it smarts.
And so there's another method on the contract. It's not working very well. That's better. Called add assembly. It's got a, you give it an assembly name. And a byte array containing the assembly. And what this does is it's a lot like, I don't know if you ever watched The Matrix, but there's that scene where, who was it? Someone needed to know how to fly a helicopter. And so they plugged their brain into something and suddenly they got all this smarts. They knew how to fly a helicopter.
Yep.
And this is a similar thing for an actor. You can say, I am now passing you an assembly, and it's going to contain all of your smarts. Okay? So what does it get from this assembly? It gets actor methods. So let's look at what an actor method might look like. So inside of your assembly, you have methods, and they're decorated with this actor method decoration. And they all have the same signature. They all return an object. And they take something called an iActor state. And a bunch of parameters, object parameters, as arguments. And what is this iActor state thingy? Well, that's one of the sort of the essential concepts behind ActorFX. And let's examine some of the things you can do with this iActor state. I hope I can fit this all on the board. Part of the iActor state is just a dictionary-like interface. So you can I'm going to have to abbreviate my signatures here. But you can take a string key and set it to any value. So it's just like a dictionary of objects. You can get the value associated with the key. You can remove a key. So that's part of what you can do inside your actor method. You can say state dot set key 1 to some object. So you can do these things where if you want to have any data that kind of persists with your actor, that's durable, you have to manipulate that data through the state interface. And these are the parts of the state interface that allow you to manipulate that data. Another thing you can do from an actor method is to publish something. So you can consider this to be sort of like event publication in .NET. And you pass it a string, event type, and any old payload you want. Whatever, some object. And so that's another method on iActor state. Event type and payload. One more thing that you can do on an actor is communicate with other actors. So another thing inside of iActor state, another method is something called get actor proxy, and you pass it an actor name. So here, in your actor method, you could say proxy is state.get actor proxy, and you give it the name of the actor that you want to communicate with. From there, you can call a method on the other actor. So you could say proxy dot call method, some method. And arguments. And in the actor world, we support both what you would call proactive communication and reactive communication. And so calling an actor method would be proactive communication. And then just as has been set up in the RX world, you can subscribe to another actor and get its events. So you can say observable equals proxy of some type. Events are typed as strings. So this means that this actor called actor name, every time it emits an event of event some type in this case, we'll be able to know about it. And you can do that by saying observer subscribe, and you pass it the name of a handler method. We're really running out of whiteboard here. But so what does a handler method look like? It looks just like any other actor method, except the very first argument is something called a an actor event. And so you can then, so you can imagine that, you know, every time that this other actor is publishing something, you're getting it, you're handling it, and it, in that way you can set up a reactive network of actors, in addition to doing the traditional calling methods on other actors. And I think if we kind of pull back from here, what we've kind of done is made a .NET object on the cloud. Right? I mean, this whole thing of passing an iActor state into a method, that's really kind of a this pointer, which kind of makes this a an instance method on the actor object. And this business about subscribing to other actors' events is really similar to subscribing to an event on some other object and handling it. So that's kind of a quick overview of what the interfaces look like, what a an actor method might look like, the kind of things you can do in an actor method.
Nice. Now, for the since you're using strings as method names, passing in arrays of arguments and stuff, that seems like reflection. So how did you implement that? Like, what's really going on?
What's really going on is when you ship an assembly, it's going to scour that assembly for everything that looks like this.
Yep.
That has the actor method decoration and this signature. And it's going to kind of cast that to a function. And it's going to store it right in the actor state. And so when you say call method, what the actor is going to do is it's going to say, oh, I see this method name. I'm going to look in my actor state and see if there's a key by this name. So if you say my method, it's going to say, oh, I have something called my method stored. I am now going to call the function that I use, call the delegate that I stored along with my method. Another important point here is this whole business of iActor state. So this iActor state is kind of an opaque thing to the actor writer. It just knows it's getting this thing called iActor state that has this contract. You can do this kind of thing on it. The actor itself actually provides the actor state, the this pointer, to the method when it gets called. And therefore, the actor can implement iActor state any way that it wants. The thing that we're focusing on right now is to implement iActor state on top of a highly available, some high availability software running on the cloud. And what it does is, if you've ever worked with high availability software, it's there's a lot of concepts to get. There's, you know, you have a primary replica usually, and one or more secondary replicas, and you have to worry about replicating all your data, and you have to worry about, you know, what happens when the primary goes down, what happens on failover. And so we are implementing an iActor state built on top of that that abstracts all those high availability details away.
Great.
And so you're just left with this thing that looks like a dictionary,
mm-hmm.
and you can have faith that whenever you make a change to that dictionary, that it's going to get replicated correctly, and that when failover occurs, that everything's going to be restored the way it's supposed to be.
Awesome. So, I mean, that's a really important point.
Yeah, absolutely. This is great. You don't need to worry about log sequence numbers or any of the weird arcane things that show up with cloud computing. This is a really simple model.
Mm-hmm.
For someone like me that came from the Common Language Runtime team, this is great. We've essentially rebuilt CLR objects in a very dynamic fashion on the cloud, on top of our high availability infrastructure.
Excellent.
This is a great way to at least allow people to not worry about any of the details for this stuff. So.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, but that's an interesting point because in some sense, this new age of cloud computing is going to require that developers start to think through what does it mean to write a connected app, a service-oriented app, when I'm going to be, you know, there's going to be the internet pipeline, it's a physics problem, you never know when things go down. The way I design and architect my apps that people will run on their devices, there's going to be a service layer, there's going to be a service component. So what does this stuff mean to me as that developer? Knowing that, you know, because in some sense I'm probably not developing the service that I'm going to use. I'm going to get an actor back. Or talk to me about the client side of this API. How's that for a straightforward question?
Well, so there's you would have to write a client for any sort of iActor state implementation that you might have. And mm-hmm. so with this particular implementation that we're working on right now, we wrote a client, and the client takes care of things like, you know, it communicates with the high availability software and says, I need to talk to this actor, tell me which one the primary is.
Mm.
So it talks to the primary, the client detects when that line goes dead, and it communicates with the high availability software and says, okay, who's the new primary? You know, connects up to that guy. So the guy, the person who is using the client,
mm-hmm.
doesn't have to do a lot of thinking about, boy, what do I do when the service goes down or something? Because the client can kind of abstract all that stuff away.
Mm-hmm.
So, in fact, Joe, what happens if I'm running a client app and then I send a message and then my server goes down? What do I do on the client? Should I reissue that request? And if this was something like transfer money in a bank account, do I run into any problems of perhaps doing that same operation twice?
Yeah, this is a great problem that Brian brings up, something we ran into, in that, boy, what do you do when you're writing a client for one of these things?
Mm-hmm.
What do you do when you send a message and it just gets, something goes dead? Because you don't know if you said, boy, I want to deposit $100, or I want to withdraw $100. Did that withdrawal actually take place before your thing went dead, or do you have to reissue that withdrawal? And mm-hmm. that's a tough question. So one thing we built into Actors is that you know, the interface is actually a little bit more complicated than this, but one thing that you send is you send a unique ID for the client, and you send a client sequence number. And the actor in the iActor state, it's mostly just the actor, it stores the result of everything it does. So it stores the latest result from each client.
Mm.
And in the case of, you know, clients issuing multiple asynchronous calls, we'll change it so it stores a big window of latest results from the client. But what basically happens is that if you reissue, your withdrawal request, the actor's going to be smart enough to say, you know, before I went down last time, I actually fulfilled that request. So I'm just going to bump that back to you without withdrawing any money.
Okay.
Okay, so we call this auto idempotence. And it relieves the writer of the client from having to worry about, well, what do I do now? Do I withdraw another $100, or do I just assume that withdrawal took place?
Awesome.
This is actually a big deal. There are some other actor frameworks out there that have looked at this problem and decided, you know what? We're going to require you to do only idempotent operations. That's great for like an add, but once you start adding in stuff like remove, then you run into real problems if you do stuff like add, and remove. You can reorder that in ways where sometimes you get two items in your list, other times you get one. And you run into some real, real pain in the butt sort of situations there. With what we're doing, you don't need to worry about trying to fit your problem space to use just idempotent operations in certain places. So this is a good way in which we've looked at some of the theory, we've looked at what's out there, and we've said, look, this is what we want to build, this is what's actually useful for programmers. So it's a great way to simplify things.
And so, I mean, in some sense, one of the powers of an actor, the actor-based programming model, is distributed computing. And I can just have sort of a farm of actors, or a garden, or whatever you want to think about it, all crunching and doing their thing.
You can hook them up in any topology that you like.
Exactly.
Have them all subscribing to each other and doing all this stuff.
And you support, it's fully supported in this model. How well does this scale at this point? Like, how many actors can I have crunching on a really big problem?
That's going to depend upon whatever high availability substrate that you build high actor state on top of. I think with the thing that we're using right now that it is maybe hundreds of actors.
Okay.
But there's no reason why that couldn't go way up in the future.
Sure. And so, just coming back down to sort of the ground from the cloud, how are you seeing this being used? Give me a real example of the power of this new model.
Yeah. So, there are a lot of interesting things that we want to start building here.
Mm-hmm.
And let me just say, there's a bunch of stuff that is a real challenge. So I'm trying to build apps for my Windows phone, and there's things that you want to do in there that are just really basic. I want to do a high score list for a game. To do that, I need to essentially get everyone's high score list from the entire world and store it somewhere. And then I need to be able to get updates to that on individual clients. And I need everyone to be able to add individual items to that. All of that stuff feels a lot like a list, a lot like an existing .NET collection. So perhaps there's a way to build essentially .NET collections that just happen to be backed by objects in the cloud, running on actors. So that's certainly where we've been doing some investigation. We've got some other long-range ideas as well. Long range being like next month. We'd like to look at a simple MapReduce framework. So you could try doing some of the complex computing stuff that people currently use cloud-based computing for. We're also looking at ways to test the scale of our actors and see how far we can go. One of the ideas we're kicking around is an app that we're calling Fakebook. So the idea here is if you look at something like Facebook, you may be able to model it as a series of actors for each person, and then perhaps you could just create a new actor instance for every single person. It's a very different way of building an application like that than using a traditional database. We think it may allow you to achieve higher scale. We need to do some work there and flesh this out, but that's certainly the direction we're looking.
Well, you'll definitely be, challenged on the scale side when you hit about, a billion actors.
Yes, exactly.
Kind of fun to see how that plays out.
Well, one other thing that we're looking at is a way to write what we call a multi-tenant actor.
Mm.
So if you have, 1,000 very simple actors, rather than starting a high availability service for each one of them, why not just jam them all into a single actor, right? And so you only have one service running that's servicing all these little sub-actors.
Mm.
And so in that way, if you had a bunch of small, simple things running, you could achieve better scale. You know, so far, I admit that's just theory and we've thought about it, but it mm-hmm. seems like something we should be able to do.
And in the multi-tenant actor case, you'd have to create multiple multi-tenant actors for durability, reliability. What's the term you guys use?
High availability.
High availability. You've been saying it for the whole interview. So
I've been
nice,
trying
Charles.
To say it.
No, you have been saying that. So that's what I mean. So if I use a multi-tenant actor, I want to be able to have a duplicate of it, right?
Right. And so, I mean, all actors are going to be replicated.
Got it.
Right. So this multi-tenant actor would just have to figure out, okay, I have these 1,000 little bitty iActor states inside of me. How mm-hmm. do I keep those all replicated so that if I die, I can resurrect them?
So one of the things that keeps popping in my head is, you know, actors, the actor model is nothing new.
Right.
Once again, it goes back to when? The 70s or maybe the 80s, maybe the 50s, maybe mm-hmm. the 60s. We know who the dude is. He could fit in any of those decades. I mean, no offense. I mean, he's older.
Mm-hmm.
But you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So why all of a sudden is this like a revelation?
Well, it may be a little bit of a shock that we are bringing the power of 1970s computer science to bear on cloud computing. But that is literally what we're doing.
Mm.
The challenges that those guys had back then was just phenomenal. You know, your machines were so slow. If you tried to do a build, well, maybe you were using punch cards and stuff like that. The computing hardware of the day was so bad, and yet they thought about all of these great ideas for trying to build a resilient model and to address scale problems.
Mm.
And they did a really good job on the conceptual level. I kind of suspect that a lot of the stuff that they needed to actually make everything run wasn't quite there yet. And we think this is the right time to do this.
Totally. And of course, I was just being a smartass.
Oh, yeah.
But it is interesting.
For any of the Channel 9 viewers out there, you may want to look at the video that Eric Meyer did with Carl Hewitt
yes.
on Channel 9. So that's a fascinating interview that Eric did.
Yep.
And Carl Hewitt goes into, you know, how an actor works, what it looks like, and a lot of the work that his lab has been doing around that as well.
Cool. So. And no offense, Carl, if you're watching this, I didn't mean you were ancient at all.
No.
But yeah, he's the inventor of the actor model.
Yes, exactly. And it's great.
Excellent. One of the things I think also is really interesting, and you sort of touched on it really briefly, Brian, was this notion of a, how would you call it, a sort of a cloud-enabled object,
mm-hmm.
the cloud list,
yes.
right? That type, which brings the cloud down with it.
Mm-hmm.
Even though as a programmer on the client side, I don't think about the cloud. I think about my client side program.
Yes. In fact, if you go and download our Actor Framework from CodePlex at actorfx.codeplex.com,
mm-hmm.
then you'll see two interesting types in there. One is called Cloud List of T, and the other is Observable Cloud List of T. So these are really what you want if you're trying to do interesting client-side applications that get data from the cloud. So we've built a simple little grocery list application where, you know, if you had, you know, perhaps you and your spouse or something like that, both of you could be running this on, ideally, phones, and you could then add and subtract things from one particular list, and all the updates gets sent instantly to everyone else that's looking at your list.
Mm.
So you can be at the store, you know, removing things, saying, hey, I just bought all these items. Well, someone at home could be adding new items to the list, too, meaning that your shopping never actually finishes. But
okay.
Great thing about this is our cloud list, our observable cloud list is built in a way where we implement all of the right interfaces for .NET. So if you want to data bind this to a grid and show a UI, that's freaking trivial for you.
Mm.
You just create an instance of the observable cloud list, and you do the data binding, and basically you're done.
Mm.
Your application is now cloud enabled, and you can share data with everyone. So,
and I think that's kind of the our aim, our motivation here is, well, all that stuff that you learned about single box computing and single box theory and all that stuff, we're just trying to tweak it a little bit and not introduce too many new concept counts.
Mm.
And it suddenly works on the cloud. I mean, what is an actor? It's just something that you call methods on. right? That's the same thing you do on a single box. Mm-hmm. You call a method, or you you grab its state, or you subscribe to it, you know. And then this iActor state is just something that intercepts mutations to your durable state.
Mm.
And so, you know, it's designed to have. It's designed to be very familiar to people who are just familiar with object-oriented computing.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it abstracts away a lot of stuff, like you're on the cloud, you're on a high availability service, you know, you're replicating everything. All that stuff just gets abstracted away, so you can just concentrate on the object-oriented model.
Excellent. And of course, actors are composable. So now we're going to start getting into some of the jargon we've done many years with this wonderful team.
Yes.
These are composable objects, right? Or concepts.
Yes. Constructs. So we're very interested in having one actor be able to talk to other actors in the cloud. Mm. So if you want to, say, have a client that submits a request that starts computation across, you know, 100 machines or something like that, that's the sort of thing that we want to enable easily.
Mm.
And as Joe showed, we've essentially got an easy way to do that with being able to get proxies to other actors. So you can subscribe to its events and call methods on it.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a great way to build the infrastructure that you need to actually go tackle these problems.
And you don't want to build dependencies, right, into another actor, right? So in other words, if I'm an actor and I want to generate a bunch of other actors to go solve a problem for me as a distributed system, right? I don't want to have too many cross dependencies between them in case something goes wrong. Explain that, how that works.
I mean, the simplest way to do that is probably, boy, when I get some information, I'm going to do my processing on it, and I'm just going to publish an event. And whoever's interested can subscribe to that event and do something with
okay.
it. So you may not even be aware of whoever else is using your information and processing it.
Mm.
And so there's very little dependency there. Now, if you call somebody's method, if you do proactive computation of other actors, then yeah, you do draw a little bit of a dependency where you say, I'm counting on this other actor to have this method named this.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, that may be a little bit more meshed.
Yeah. But of course, that you want to expect that to be the case, right? But I mean, you could get yourself into some trouble with really complex systems is all I'm throwing out there.
Yeah, that's possible. But a lot of the patterns that we are using here are not really new to many people. We're using a common pattern called PubSub for mm-hmm. publish and subscribe. That's a really simple way of essentially listening to events from another actor on a different machine.
Mm.
A lot of this stuff it's interesting, and it's not really new to a lot of the people who have been in this space for a while. And by bringing to bear a few existing concepts and
yeah.
putting them in the right place in the right way,
sure.
We can go a long ways. And it turns out that even the reactive extensions for .NET led us in the right direction here.
Mm.
We're using their iSubject in a few places to implement our PubSub mechanism.
Mm.
So there's a lot of good stuff there. And the best part is that you, the Channel 9 viewer, do not need to think about this much when you're using this.
Understood. But of course, a lot of the Channel 9ers like to think about the things they're using.
Oh, of course. You can't build anything real without really understanding it. However,
sure.
You know, you do not need a degree in cloud computing to be able to get started.
Amen. That's mm-hmm. very excellent.
Yeah, and I think one of the traditional problems with actors has been there's a possibility to deadlock if you call synchronous methods on each other. So that's one thing to think about, right? When you do this call method guy, you need to do some thinking, like
mm-hmm.
What's going to happen when I call that method? How soon is he going to get back to me? Is he going to try to call a method on me?
Mm.
So you have to think about stuff like that. The publish and subscribe stuff, I think, is much more forgiving. It's all done a lot more asynchronously, so you could actually ping-pong messages between two actors if you wanted.
So that actually brings up that's a kind of an interesting point. Why not have a requirement, I mean, it is the cloud, for a call method async? So in the WinRT world, for example, on the client, you can't do anything that's not asynchronous. So you don't block the UI thread. But in this case, you don't want to lock the actor mesh.
It is. We basically have async method calls. Now, the one thing that is different is that, I mean, no matter how much we give the appearance of asynchrony, like in the clients where we hand you back a task and say, we'll will fire this thing when your job is done.
Mm-hmm.
One of the tenets of actors is that every actor method, these guys, has exclusive access to the actor state.
Mm-hmm.
That's why you don't have to do things in here like, well, I better put a lock around here because someone else may be setting this key one.
Of course.
You've got the exclusive access, and it makes it real easy to write methods because you don't have to think about other people messing with it at the same time you are. But at the same time, it does mean that only one method is running at a time. So at some point, there is an explicit lock that says, this guy's going to run, and this guy's going to run, and this guy's going to run, and there is this sequentialization of methods.
Hmm.
So let's go a bit further in that. When I was on the CLR team, one of the things we were really worried about was asynchronous exceptions, like thread abort exception, that can occur between any two machine instructions. And we needed to build a bunch of infrastructure to mitigate that, or at least allow you to write something where you can set two fields in an interesting way. We built constrained execution regions for that on the client. They were ridiculously complicated, and basically no one used them. And you know what? That's probably the right call for that, too, for the most part. However, an interesting challenge here is we can be writing to an iActor state, and perhaps an actor goes down halfway through. I wonder if there's any consistency problems we could run into there. What do you think, Joe?
Well, so hidden inside of all this stuff is that you can do all kinds of manipulation on your internal state inside your actor method. But what happens is that everything that you do is stored in a side effect buffer.
Hmm.
And it's only when, so in the guts here, it's only when your actor method is completed that side effect buffer is sort of flushed out to the regular durable state. And so there's transaction-like semantics there where you'll never get the situation where you do this, and then this throws an exception, and you have to wonder, boy, what did I get done before I died there?
Mm-hmm.
You know that either all of your state mutations are going to be in effect or none of them are going to be in effect.
Cool.
Yeah, so that's awesome. This means it's really easy to build something and not have to worry too much about all the failure modes.
Mm.
Certainly you don't want to have failures in the first place, but we have a great way of at least allowing you to maintain a relatively high degree of consistency without too much additional thought.
So let me ask you a question then.
Mm-hmm.
Because in reality, exceptions happen, right? That should be a bumper sticker,
yeah.
Right? They just
yes.
do. That's just the way it works. So let's say I have an actor mesh or whatever you want to call this thing, and I'm doing my thing, and an exception happens in one of them and not in the other. They're both doing the same thing, right? So these are sort of mirrors of each other. How does that exception get propagated back? Do exceptions even matter? Like, what happens? Do you just spin up a new instance of that actor to complete?
Now, when you say mirrors of each other, you're talking about replicas, like primary
yes.
replicas and secondary replicas?
You got it.
So at least the way that it works right now with our particular iActor state implementation
mm-hmm.
is that you only do things on the primary. You only send messages to the primary and say, do stuff for me. And then when you're kind of done executing the method, you do some logic to replicate it.
Okay.
So there's, I mean, the secondary guys aren't doing anything really smart. They're just taking the state mutations that have been done on the primary and copying them.
Okay.
Okay, so to the point of your question, though, I mean, if this method were to throw an exception, the client that called it would get a message back saying, hey, your method threw an exception.
Okay.
If, you know, things got so bad that this guy just died, if it calls environment.failfast or whatever the call is, then you'll end up in that situation that we described earlier where the client is just going to notice my line went dead. Now I have to reconnect to the new primary because one of the secondaries is going to get promoted to primary at that point. And then, luckily, we have the auto idempotence logic that says, you know, you can feel free to resubmit your request, and if we've already serviced it, we'll just give you the same reply that we gave before without actually doing any logic.
Okay.
So what Joe just described is a ton of plumbing that you need to do if you're trying to build a real cloud-enabled application. Everyone's going to need to build that plumbing themselves unless you use something like the Actor Framework.
Mm-hmm.
So we think this is a real interesting advantage. And you got to put in the right amount of thought into failures, both on the client side and on the actor side, both for failing clients and for failing actors. And when you have actors talking to other actors, you need to deal with those failures too.
Hmm.
So it's an interesting set of dimensions there.
It is. And you mentioned, just to, as we wind down here, I mean, the cloudless is, I think, a really cool type.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to have situations where you're both, it's going to be more complicated than a shopping list. Maybe it's you know, an office pool for some sporting event or something where you have a bunch of data coming in and out.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to fail for some people, not fail for other people. Some people are going to go through a tunnel while, you know, halfway through sending up the information. You guys are dealing with all the synchronization. Because in reality, how many, so let's say you have 600 people using a cloudless instance. How many cloudless mirrors of that, or whatever it's going to be called, are in the cloud?
So right now we're looking at having maybe 3 different replicas of a particular object.
Okay.
But that's a very tunable parameter that users can set.
Mm.
So it really depends on the amount of redundancy you want. There are some ideas around geo-replication as well. So you may have stuff in a data center in Washington State,
mm-hmm.
but perhaps also in Texas at the same time. We haven't quite bridged that gap yet, but that's the sort of thing that we do want to at least look at in the long term as something that we can provide.
Excellent.
And, the number of replicas really isn't a function of how heavily used you are.
Mm.
It's simply, if I have one replica, then there's this much chance that both of them could go down, I could lose everything. If I have two replicas, there's less of a chance that all three of them are going to go down. You know, if I have three replicas, I'm in even better shape. So the number of replicas you choose is simply a function of how much risk you want to take with your data. But to answer your question, if we were to have, you know, a whole bunch of clients on a single actor, what that means is that we probably need to partition that actor. So maybe half the information would go here and half the information would go here, or maybe 2 different actors.
Mm.
I think one of the holy grails here is dynamic partitioning. So that you could tell in real time, boy, I'm really busy. I got to split myself off.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, what we mostly see around is static partitioning, so that you can make some amount of prediction and say, I think I'm going to be busy, so I'm going to make this many partitions.
Mm-hmm.
But I would love to move into the world of dynamic partitioning. We have to do more thinking about that, and the people that we're working with have to do more thinking about that.
I bet. Because it's a problem that goes all the way down, right?
Yeah.
Was it turtles all the way down? Is that the expression?
I don't know about that.
Okay. But it's for
yeah.
sure. I mean, the underneath infrastructure would have to help you there, too.
Yeah, absolutely. So.
Right on. So what else, Brian? It can't be it, man. Just kidding.
Well, no.
So what do you want Niners to do, man? They're going to download this. They're going to play with it. They're going to give you feedback.
Yeah. Absolutely. So go to actorfx.coplex.com. And try it out.
Mm-hmm.
We do have a few limitations right now, like this stuff is only X64 only for the time being. We're hoping to solve that soon. Go play with it. Tell us what you think.
Cool.
And by the way, the current stuff that we release really only supports Azure simulation on your local box.
Ah.
Okay, and so it allows you to play with this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And we hope it'll be soon when we are able to say, okay, now that you've developed your actor, we're going to ship it to the cloud. You can play with it on the cloud. But for now, it is unfortunately more of an academic thing, and we hope that in the next few months we'll support cloud deployment as well.
Great. And now this is open source?
It is open source.
So people can actually go in and help you guys create the dynamic actors.
We'd love to have some help.
You hear that, Exoteric and company out there, man, and Sven and all you guys? Come on. Right on.
Yeah.
That's a hard problem. Great to come and talk to you.
Yeah. Hey, thanks for doing this. Thank you for listening.
Yeah.
And I hope you learned something interesting.
Cool. And great meeting you, Joe.
Yeah.
We'll be talking to you again soon.
Definitely.
Mm-hmm.